From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
It's another election year. Reporters have descended on Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina in droves. But the real campaign starts in late summer when the national political conventions have nominated their candidates and the air armada of campaign planes and press planes and buses takes off. But before the air travel era, there was the campaign train chugging from coast to coast. I'm Irv Chapman, a longtime member of the National Press Club. On this edition of Update One, I'll discuss that almost bygone era with Edward Siegel, whose new book about historic political campaigns is called Whistle Stop Politics. A century ago, people would know what a whistle stop is, but for the benefit of non-centenarians, what was a whistle stop?
A whistle stop campaign train is literally a politician, whether running for office or in office, talking to voters or supporters from the back of a train as it stops at a railroad station or a depot. It used to be the best and sometimes the only way for politicians to reach and connect with voters and for voters to connect with elected officials.
A whistle stop was a stop that wasn't really on the schedule?
Yeah, that's how the term first originated, where a conductor, if he saw people wanting to get on or off the train, he would pull the whistle and the engineer would stop the train. But that term later became a derogatory term that people thought referred to a podunk or a backwater town.
Well, in some cases, I guess it really did when the campaign wanted to reach people in that town. The most elegant of campaign trains is called the Ferdinand Magellan. Tell us how it came to be.
The Ferdinand Magellan was really the Air Force One of its day. It was a converted railroad car that the American Railroad Association donated to the White House. They spent about $10 to acquire the train and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to turn it into a moving fortress where the president, President Roosevelt, had the opportunity when he traveled around the country campaigning and during World War II on his secret visits around the country. It was a great, safe, and protected way for him to travel and also to campaign when he went on the campaign trail.
Well, we'll get to the Roosevelt campaign itself in a moment, but presidents and candidates used trains for travel long before they were used for political barnstorming. Who was the first to make speeches from the rear of a train?
The first documented case was William Henry Harrison in 1836. That was about less than a decade after the train system started in this country. Of course, he didn't go too far because there weren't that many places to go, and the tracks did not travel too far. He actually traveled from Baltimore to what's now Ellicott City, Maryland. That was the first documented case.
Well, what about the first candidate who was really able to travel long distances by train and stump?
The trendsetter who set the gold standard for campaign trains was William Jennings Bryan in 1896 when he was running for president. He traveled through 27 states, made hundreds of speeches, and spoke to an estimated 5 million people. And his success in campaigning, although he didn't win, the way he campaigned, his energy and enthusiasm, that really set the standards for hundreds of politicians who followed him.
Is that where he made this famous Cross of Gold speech? Do you remember the
the
content of that?
I don't remember the content, but that was one of the speeches he delivered from the back of the train across the country.
Yes, thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. He was railing against, I guess, the corporations. When was a loudspeaker first installed and the campaign speech heard on the train itself?
That was probably done in the 1930s or 1940s, and it was a great innovation at his time because it made, for reporters who covered campaign trains, it made their life a lot easier. They did not have to get off the train. They did not have to run to the back of the train to listen to the candidate. All they had to do was listen to the speech from the comfort of their press car. It made their lives a lot easier.
Well, some presidents and candidates used the campaign train more effectively than others. And you mentioned Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Tell us about that.
Yeah, FDR had a lot of experience with campaign trains. He was running for vice president under Cox in 1920, and FDR ran his own campaign train tour across the country. They didn't win, of course, but that experience really helped him in good stead when he ran for president in 1932. And he really set the record for the number of miles that a politician could campaign by train. Hundreds of thousands of miles across the country, hundreds of speeches, and he talked to and connected with millions of people.
And how did he use the speeches? Were they prepared remarks, or did he regale the crowd, depending on what he saw in front of him?
No, he really shied away from set standard speeches. He really enjoyed having informal conversations, whether there were hundreds or thousands of people who came out to see him. So it was more of the setting, what was later to be his famous fireside chats. These were conversations he had with people. Often they were customized for who he was talking to reflect his knowledge of the local traditions or landmarks or famous people. But it was a great way for him to connect, and people never thought he was giving a speech. They thought he was having a conversation with him. So that was a great effective way for FDR to campaign from the back of a train.
Well, Harry Truman was well known for riding the train to unexpected victory, and also for the guy in the crowd who yelled, "Give 'em hell, Harry." And Truman responded something like, "I tell it like it is, and they think it's hell." What was Truman like as a campaigner?
Well, I think his campaign train, as you said, it was an underdog campaign for the White House. I think that was the tipping point for him to connect with people. The reporters who were traveling with him, they never gave him a chance of winning, even though as time went by, more people would come out. The crowds got larger and larger. They were energetic and enthusiastic. One of the interesting parts, though, of the way Truman campaigned by train is that at night he often enjoyed playing poker with the reporters who covered him, and he would ask the reporters over the poker games how he was doing. And the journalists, surprisingly, would give them their advice on how well he was doing or what he could do to improve his speeches, and Truman would often follow the advice of the journalists. And later the reporters remarked that the more Truman followed their advice, the better he got.
Well, Truman liked reporters enough when he was a senator to be active in the National Press Club and even to play the piano in the club, for which he was famously photographed. He was also photographed holding up a newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, that said, "Dewey defeats Truman." Do you remember that incident?
Yes, I write about that in the book. In fact, he held up that famous headline a couple days after the election, and the image people remember, they don't realize it, but a pull-away shot shows him actually holding up the newspaper from the back of the Magellan campaign train. So he surprised a lot of people, and that image of him holding up the newspaper headline, that really said it all. And again, his ability to campaign by train, I think, was a tipping point that led to his surprising underdog victory.
Well, he campaigned against the do-nothing 80th Congress, which may be the theme that we may hear more about in this campaign year. And even after the candidates turned to charter flights, some still scheduled a brief whistle-stop train ride. Who did that and why?
A lot of candidates have campaigned by train to the surprise of reporters who thought that it was an outdated way to seek votes. In the 1950s, many of the candidates shied away from trains and started a campaign by buses and by planes across the country. But a lot of folks, if it makes sense, they would go back to the trains as a way to show and demonstrate an old-fashioned way of campaigning. But surprisingly, it served as what I call eye candy, as a great way to attract the attention of the press, the public, and voters. So I still think it's an effective way to campaign.
Let's see, who did that? Reagan did, others?
More than 200 candidates I've documented in my research for the book have campaigned by train. Ronald Reagan did it, running for president in 1984 for a couple hundred mile trip in Ohio. And ironically, he campaigned from the Magellan car that FDR and Truman had used. but it is not an outdated way of campaigning. Joe Biden, running for president in 2020, he campaigned by train. There was a U.S. Senate candidate in Vermont in 2022. He campaigned by train, and he won. So I think that campaign trains are still around and can be used effectively by politicians.
Well, Biden calls himself Amtrak Joe, who commuted from Wilmington to Washington for years by Amtrak. So maybe he'll do it again. What was it like in the press cars? Was it great fun or great travail?
Both. It depended on the candidate, depended on the organization of the train. Many times the train would reflect the organization and the attitude and the temperament of the campaign and their staff. It could be a grueling situation, though, for reporters. Merriman Smith, the longtime reporter for UPI, he said that covering a campaign train tour was probably one of the hardest jobs in journalism. Why? Because the reporters had to be on call almost 24/7. There was no way of knowing when the train might stop and do an impromptu trackside rally, and the reporters would have to leave the train sometimes in the middle of the night, would be woken up, and go out and cover the candidate. It could be a very unpredictable life for the reporters.
Well, that was because some of these candidates were so enamored of the campaign train that when they saw practically a handful of people along the tracks, they blew the whistle and stopped the train.
That's right. That happened several times when Dwight Eisenhower was running for president in 1952 and Harry Truman in 1948. One of the stories I write about in the book is Alice Dunnigan, who was the first black reporter to travel on a presidential campaign train. She was one of the few reporters to get off the train when Truman's train stopped unscheduled, and he spoke to several students who wanted to hear him speak. And he said some things that were newsworthy about civil rights. She got the scoop. She wrote the story, and a lot of reporters who did not bother to get out, they pestered her to tell them what he had said. She refused, and she got the scoop on that story.
It was also a problem for African-American reporters as campaign trains went down south, or did they try to avoid the problem?
Dwight Eisenhower in 1952, he was very sensitive to that segregation issue because oftentimes black reporters could not stay at hotels in southern cities. So Eisenhower and his staff arranged that the train would never stay overnight in a segregated city, and reporters did not have to worry about that problem.
But when the train did stop overnight, that gave reporters a chance to use a hotel room and take care of certain ordinary chores that were not easy on the train.
Yes, that was a big problem. Hygiene, the ability to have clean laundry, that was one of the great perks of staying overnight at a hotel where the reporters could get their laundry done. Or sometimes the reporters would ship their dirty laundry to another city where they knew they would be staying, and they would pick up their clean laundry in that city later on in the trip.
Well, some states continued the prohibition of alcohol during the time that you're talking about. Did the campaign train have to obey those dry laws?
Indeed. Some reporters could be very ingenious in how they got around those laws. One reporter I write about in the book actually customized a trench coat that he carried with him and had several pockets put in the inside of his coat. And in each pocket, he put a flask or small bottle of liquor that he would be able to imbibe without getting caught by the authorities or being reported for violating the liquor laws of the states where the train was traveling at the time.
What about mishaps? Were reporters who got off the train to take the pulse of the crowd ever left behind?
Yeah, the early departure of some campaign trains literally left reporters stranded at the station. So many reporters were left when the train departed that some reporters established what they called the Left Behind Club. And in the press car, someone would put out a large map of the U.S. and gold stars where some of their colleagues had been left at the station. It was also could also be a problem for whistle-stopping candidates. The famous story of Thomas Dewey, running for president. At one of his whistle-stop train tours, the train pulled away from the station before he was finished speaking. And he yelled, "Who is that idiot engineer? He should be shot at dawn. No one was injured, so maybe we'll give him a pass." That phrase, the lunatic engineer, came back to haunt Dewey because reporters covered it and Truman took advantage of it and used that phrase against Dewey in Truman's effort to seek support from railroad workers across the country. So sometimes a slip of the tongue could generate more news coverage than prepared remarks.
If a reporter was left behind, how did he or she ever catch up?
Well, they would literally play catch up, sometimes by catching the next train and trying to catch up to the campaign train. Sometimes reporters would rent or borrow a car and speed like hell to catch up to the train. One time there was a group of reporters left behind by Dewey, and the car was running parallel to the train tracks. Dewey looked out and waved to them, and the reporters were waving back. And Dewey thought they were supporters, and reporters were trying to get the train to stop.
Did the train ever crash?
There have been instances of train crashes. Famous example, again, with Dewey in 1944, when in Castle Rock, Washington, his train crashed into a freight train that was just sitting on the tracks. Reporters and even Dewey later said this was the stupidest accident, railroad accident, because everyone knew the freight train was there, but for some reason the engineer of Dewey's train failed to see it, didn't slow down fast enough, and they ran into the train. Dewey's train was derailed. There were some people who were injured. Two reporters from Associated Press were on the train. They were slightly injured, but they were able to climb out of the train car, check on people, and was able to file a story about the accident.
It looks like Truman had it all over Dewey every day of the week in every particular manner. What about the wives of candidates? Did they have a role?
It was very unusual for the wives of candidates to speak on the behalf of their husbands. Many of the candidates took their wives or family members, and their role was really more supportive. They would wave to the crowd, but they would never, ever, ever say anything. Harry Truman would often bring his family, Margaret, his daughter, and Bess, his wife, and sometimes his family members were more popular than Truman and would demand to see and hear his family members. But it was not until 1964, when Lady Bird Johnson campaigned on behalf of her husband in the South, that a woman really took a prominent leadership role in a campaign train. She was the first woman to have her own campaign train, and people thought that her ability to travel throughout the South for several days to generate support was an important part of her husband's victory in 1964.
One other story about the use of the train that was not a political campaign per se or a re-election campaign was Woodrow Wilson, who used it after World War I. Would you recall that?
Yes, Wilson wanted to campaign by train across the country, not in support of his role as president, but he wanted to generate public support for the League of Nations. The League of Nations treaty was foundering in the U.S. Senate, and he thought by campaigning across the country in support of the treaty, that might put pressure on the Senate to pass the treaty. Unfortunately, he left Washington, D.C. on that trip. He wasn't feeling all that well. His doctors and advisors advised him strongly not to go because of his health. He overruled them, went on the trip anyway, but as the trip progressed, he felt worse and worse and worse. And then at one point, the doctor said, "You got to go back to Washington," canceled the rest of his trip, and the train sped back to Washington where they could take better care of him.
Is there any other favorite anecdote that you put in the book that we haven't touched on?
My favorite story is the fact that so many presidential and other candidates allowed other people to impersonate them on the campaign trail. In 1908, William Jennings Bryan was campaigning for president again. His train was traveling through Kentucky. He had thought he was done for the evening and took off his jacket and started to work on another speech. But unbeknownst to him, the train was making another campaign stop, and he was not going to be there. A member of Congress thought that Bryan was going to be on the back of the train with him, and he wouldn't. A reporter who heard about this decided to step in and help the member of Congress. And the reporter, who went unnamed, but slightly resembled Bryan, he put on the jacket, he borrowed the hat that Bryan wore, and when the campaign train stopped at the station, he appeared on the back of the train impersonating Bryan. The member of Congress stood next to him and waved, and everybody was happy. And then the impersonating reporter gave a few remarks similar to what Bryan would have delivered. So no one was the wiser until decades later someone wrote about this story. But that was not the first time that it's happened. Other family members, reporters, aides have impersonated other politicians, including Dwight Eisenhower, FDR, Harry Truman, and others.
Well, without naming names, maybe some reporters were better qualified than the candidates they covered. I've been talking with Edward Siegel, author of the new book, Whistle Stop Politics. I'm Irv Chapin of the National Press Club in Washington. Thanks.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.